You're listening to the Alan Gray Podcast. I'm Richard Carter. I head up assurance at Alan Gray, and I'm your host for this episode. South Africa is set to see the implementation of the new two-pot retirement system in just a few weeks. In October 2022, I joined Misha Townsend to discuss retirement reform and unpack the aims of the two-pot system. Now, almost 2 years later, we're set to implement the system, which arguably should see better retirement outcomes for South African savers in years to come. Today, I'm joined by Sean Duddy to discuss the changes and the implications for people saving for retirement. Sean joined Alan Gray almost 15 years ago and is the head of our product development team. He spends a lot of his time researching and analyzing the options that investors have and the choices they can make to lead to the best retirement outcomes. Sean, thank you for joining us. You've spent almost 15 years at Alan Gray. What has kept you here?
You actually hired me, and you're one of the people that have kept me here. The quality of the people that work within Alan Gray and within my team specifically have been fantastic. The opportunity to learn has been great, and the quality of the thinking and the problems that we solve keep me engaged. So there's numerous reasons, but those are probably the top ones.
Excellent. Well, let's move on to today's topic. Can we start with the basics? What is the new two-pot system and how will it work?
The intention of the two-pot system is to improve retirement outcomes for retirement savers. How the system aims to do that is by ensuring that at least two-thirds of members' future contributions make it to retirement. So going forward from 1 September, each contribution you make will be split into two components, hence the two pots. One-third will go into a savings component. From that component, people will have the option once per tax year to do a withdrawal in the case of a real financial emergency. That is its intention. The remaining two-thirds is going to go into a retirement component. That component cannot be touched until the person gets to retirement. And even when they do get to retirement, it has to be used to purchase an income-providing product, which will provide them with an income throughout their retirement. So that's how it's going to work. If you contrast that to where we've come from, what is different is the fact that the majority of the contributions make it to retirement compared to today, where if you're in a pension fund or a provident fund, for example, if you change your employment, you actually have the option to take 100%. That's been quite damaging from a retirement savings perspective in the past, with people opting to take 100% more often than not and then having to start from scratch again. So the opportunity to ensure that the majority makes it to the end now should be very positive.
And tell me, what is this seeding that I keep hearing about?
Very simply, on day one, what seeding is going to allow is for there to be a portion of your assets immediately available, right? So if you were to start it without seeding, you'd say, I have my existing assets, none of which is accessible. So in order to give people an opportunity to access something on day one, we're going to go through seeding. The way that that actually works is that at the end of August, each retirement fund is going to look at how much you have in your retirement fund account. They're going to say, let's take 10% of that and compare that to 30,000. You can either take the 10% or 30,000. So maybe as an example, I think this is useful. If you have 200,000 in your retirement fund account, we'll say, what is 10%? We'll say that's 20,000. And we'll move that into your savings component on day one, which will be accessible. If you have 500,000 in your account, though, you'll take 10% of that, get 50,000, and then we'll say, okay, no, that's greater than 30,000, and we'll just seed with 30. That ensures that on the 1st of September, for people who really need access to a portion of their retirement savings, there is something there, rather than having to wait for their contributions to build that up.
So it's a once-off thing just to get things going?
Absolutely. So seeding will only happen once. Strictly speaking, should be on the 1st of September. Different retirement funds, depending on how well they implement, might do it slightly after that. We will be seeding clients on the 1st of September, and that will be it. From there on, the only assets that will go into your savings component will be from your new contributions.
Okay, so if up to 10% of my existing assets are being taken out and seeded to start this new savings pot, what happens to the rest of the existing assets?
The rest of the existing assets are going to go into a third component, which will be called the vested component. And the intention of that component is to retain the existing pre-two-pot rules for those assets. So everything that is in your vested component, except obviously the portion that's, you know, been seeded into your savings component, effectively nothing is going to change for those assets. So you will be able to access them at the same points and in the same way as you have to date. Maybe as a useful example there, if you're in a provident fund, you will have the vast majority of your assets on day one going into this vested component and 10% up to 30,000 into your savings component. If you were unfortunately retrenched 3 months later towards the end of the year, what that would mean is that your vested components will still have the exact same rules, which means that on retrenchment, you can choose to access those assets. Plus, you'll have your savings component where you can make an election. And if you've made any contributions in between, you'll have a retirement component. But for your existing assets, nothing changes. All the rules stay exactly the same.
So does that mean if I'm entitled to a once-off withdrawal in a preservation fund at the moment that I haven't yet used, I can still exercise that at any point should I need to after the two-pot system's gone live?
That is correct. Any assets that exist on the 31st of August that are not used to seed, nothing will change, including access to a once-off withdrawal.
I guess that this means that it's going to take a while before people have a, you know, meaningful amount of money built up in these two pots. What about people who are close to retirement, like people who are over 55? How does this affect them?
For the majority of people that are 55 or older or getting close to retirement, they will be seeded like everyone else. For those members, they effectively have a choice with their savings component. They could say, well, I'm going to be retiring in a year or two or three or whatever it might be. So I'm not going to touch anything. I'm going to wait until I get there and I'm going to make my election, you know, to take a certain portion as cash and to annuitize the rest. In other words, draw an income from a product. That's probably the most sensible thing to do if you're close to retirement. And the reason I say that is when you get to retirement and elect to take cash, the tax treatment of anything you take as cash is more favorable than if you were to draw from your savings component. When you draw from your savings component, it's going to be taxed at your marginal income tax rate, which is actually higher than what you would experience when you look at your salary. So you say, well, here's my salary. A certain amount has been taken off as tax. You know, what is that as a percentage? That's your effective tax rate. Your marginal tax rate is higher than that and is the highest bracket in the tax table that you're subject to. And that's also higher than the tax that would be applicable at retirement. So, you know, waiting to retirement and then making your election there is probably a good idea, but you do have a choice. If you really needed access now, you could do so. And that will be the case for most people approaching retirement. There is a subset of retirees or people approaching retirement that are actually not included in the two-pot retirement system. To get an idea if this applies to you, you would have had to be 55 years of age or older on the 1st of March 2021. You would have had to be in a provident fund on that day, and you would still need to be in that provident fund today. The reason why you are excluded is because on the 1st of March 2021, the retirement industry took an initial step towards two-pot, which was called harmonization, and that aligned, you know, retirement annuity funds with pension funds with provident funds. And so for provident fund members, in order to keep as many of their pre-existing rights, they were, call it, grandfathered. So for those members, they're not immediately opted in to two-pot. And so for them, they won't be seeded immediately. So if you're approaching retirement there, the default would be you'd wait for retirement and then you'd make your choice. You can choose to opt in and be seeded, in which case it would align with what I said earlier.
And what about RAs? You mentioned retirement funds. I mean, people in RAs don't get to take money out when they change jobs anyway. So How does this affect people in RAs?
The retirement funds that are included is all of them. So that means pension funds, provident funds through your employer. If you have a pension or provident preservation fund, they are also included. And as you said, if you have a retirement annuity fund, you are also included. What is interesting in the context of two-pot is that for pension and provident funds, historically, you've been able to access money before retirement when you change your employer. And therein lies the problem previously, which is that at those points, you could take 100% and then have to start all over again. So the two-pot system is an improvement relative to that. In the retirement annuity fund, however, you've never been able to access money before retirement, except in very specific scenarios, like if you immigrate or you cease to be a tax resident. So there's always been 100% preservation. And what the two-pot system is actually going to do in those funds is now create an opportunity for those members to access a portion of their money before retirement, right? So in some ways, one could argue that in a retirement annuity fund, the two-pot system might be reducing preservation, and it will call on members to have greater discipline in the preservation of their own retirement funds going forward. But they are treated exactly the same. They'll have a savings component and a retirement component in the same way as a pension or provident fund member.
So this is, I mean, quite a major revamp of the way we think about retirement savings and of the industry. Why are we doing all this?
Preservation, though, is an extremely important thing to be able to get right for a number of reasons. One, as an individual and as a retirement fund member, the reason why you are contributing to your retirement fund is to provide for yourself when you ultimately get to retirement. So any helping hand along the way that improves your potential retirement outcome should be deemed a good thing. What we've seen in the South African context and in retirement funds specifically has been pretty poor preservation rates. And we've also seen that when people do ultimately get to retirement, their ability to sustain their income that they were experiencing when they had a job has also not been very good for the reasons that we outlined earlier, right? People access their retirement funds each time they change their employer, and so they end up reaching retirement with very little. So that's why it's important, because we are looking as an industry and as a society in South Africa to improve one's ability to get to retirement with a reasonably meaningful amount of assets that will be able to support you in a reasonably good way throughout your retirement. So that is why we're going through all of this effort, why we're going through this big change, is in the intention and the hope to fundamentally improve people's retirements in, you know, the next 20 years.
So if we're doing this to improve retirement outcomes, in other words, to improve the levels of income that people get once they've retired, do you think it's going to work? Is it going to improve preservation? Will it eventually lead to better incomes in retirement?
Yes, I think it will. But it does depend on a couple of things being done correctly by the member. So there are a number of, you know, missteps or risks that people need to avoid. So in pension and provident funds, you now won't be able to access 100% of your capital if you change employers. Okay, so that in and of itself should improve the outcome relative to what we've seen in the past. If you continue to contribute at a similar rate throughout your working career towards retirement, then relative to the two-pot system not being in place, you will be in a better position, right? Assuming that you would have taken, you know, meaningful amounts of your assets along the way. So in that space, what's required for this to be better is continue to contribute in a regular way as you would have, and you're able to access less. So I'd say in those funds, assuming that people continue to use retirement funds to save towards retirement, you should see improvement. In the retirement annuity fund space, it's more nuanced, and it's less obvious to me that you'll see an improvement, because if you assume that all of those members in a retirement annuity fund have been happy to contribute to date and have been happy to access nothing along the way, and then you say to them, well, you now have an opportunity to, you know, do one withdrawal per tax year, in order to just be in the same position as you would have otherwise been, those members need to avoid the temptation of dipping into their retirement fund assets. If they don't, and they start to withdraw along the way, then my expectation is that they might end up in a worse position, unless they do something to offset it. like contribute more over time or top up the money. So I think you're going to see a blend of some retirement funds having better outcomes and some having worse. And I think what's very important is conversations like these and information sharing and articulating to retirement fund members what they need to watch out for, what the new rules are trying to achieve, and how they can get the maximum out of those rules to do so. So yes, across the board, I would say it should lead to better outcomes, but there are definitely some pockets where there is some risk.
What is it that members need to look out for?
The first one is you're going to be given access to a portion of your retirement funds. Okay, now that might be more or less than what you've had in the past, but you are still going to have access to a portion of your retirement funds. The intention of your retirement fund assets should always be to support you in retirement, which means the starting point should be not to withdraw them, to leave them invested, give them the maximum opportunity, the maximum amount of time, the maximum access to investment returns to get to your retirement and provide you with an appropriate income. So the first thing to avoid is doing a withdrawal, unless you absolutely need to. The reason why the two-pot system gives you the ability to do a withdrawal is that there is an acknowledgement that for a lot of people in South Africa, their retirement savings is a big part, if not their only meaningful savings pot, right? And if you said to someone, well, we're asking you to contribute and save for your retirement, it's good for you. And at some point in your life, for whatever reason, you hit a snag, you lose your job, you have no income, it's difficult to say to a person, well, you've got this big pot of money here, you're, you know, now subject to taking out debt, you're struggling, you can't have access to any of it. So there is a rationale for giving people access, but it really should be a last resort. The other one is that we're now moving from a reality where you would have seen your retirement fund as one thing or your retirement account as one block of assets. There was no concept of component A, component B, etc. It was just one block of assets, and you were looking to invest it in a way that you could get a reasonable amount of investment growth. We're now moving to a world where hopefully every single retirement fund and administrator is going to say to you, here are your assets. This portion is your retirement component. You cannot touch that. That has to last all the way to retirement. And here is another component. It's your savings component. Please also try not to touch that, but if you really need to, you can. And the other thing to avoid is starting to invest the savings component very differently to the retirement component. And by that, what I mean is, even if you've told yourself, my plan is not to withdraw, if you might still choose to invest it in, call it shorter term, safer assets, just in case you need to. So you say like, my plan is not to, but I don't want to lose any money there because just in case I might need it. And there can be material consequences for choosing to invest those assets, for example, in cash instead of a balanced fund. And when your ultimate objective is for your assets to get as much growth over time in the build-up to retirement, exposing them to lower growth assets can have a big difference in what you end up with. The last one, which is not specifically related to the two-pot system, continue to try and contribute regularly and at a reasonable level. If you can get those things right, and I don't want to oversimplify them because I know it's a tough thing to get right, but if you can get those things right, the two-pot system will be fantastic for you, should be fantastic for retirement fund members in general, and for South Africa in 20 to 30 years, the picture could look a lot better.
So to paraphrase, the risk you see is that people will view this as some sort of short-term emergency fund, potentially not build up other emergency savings that they need because now they can rely on their pension fund, and then invest it more cautiously, which is a drag on returns. So if I've now got these two pots plus all the previous money saved up and I don't withdraw anything, I follow your advice, and I keep the money, don't touch it. Am I worse off in any way by having the money divided up into different pots? Am I in exactly the same place as I would have been?
Yes. The benefit of a retirement fund in terms of why you would choose to invest in a retirement fund relative to a normal discretionary investment is the tax benefits, right? So nothing is changing on that front. When your contributions come in, the same amount of tax deductibility applies. You continue to get tax-free returns in your retirement fund. And then when you get to the end, you get to make a choice in terms of what you allocate to an income-providing vehicle and what you allocate or choose to take as cash. And the tax treatment there is the same. So across all of those aspects, from the beginning, during contributing and getting to the end, everything will be exactly the same, except you'll see these different buckets. The one element that is worth noting is when you get to retirement, you will now have these various pots. Like I said, the retirement component you have to put into an income-providing vehicle. The savings component, you can choose whether you put it into an income-providing vehicle or take it as cash. But that savings component is the cash that you are allowed to take. Today, before the two-pot system comes into place, that looks slightly different in the sense that what we say today is, let's look at your total retirement funds. You can take a maximum of a third in cash and the rest must go into an income-providing vehicle. It's very subtle and the net outcome is very, very similar, but the way it's defined looks a little bit different. But overall, if you contribute consistently, you don't withdraw and you invest in the same way, you should be in the same place. So for you, if you're that member, two-pot should be a little bit of a non-event for you in a good way.
And just carrying on with that, if I'm that member that doesn't plan to withdraw any money, what do I need to do with this whole two-pot thing?
Nothing. I think it's worth you, again, listening to conversations like these, applying your mind, understanding what is changing. But in terms of physical action, you don't have to do anything. Continue contributing as you are. Actually, don't change your investment strategy if it's set up for, a good level of returns. And when you get to retirement, do what you would have done. So for you, nothing.
And when I get to retirement with money left over in that savings pot that I haven't withdrawn, as you said, I can still take it as the current one-third cash, or I can buy an annuity and income. I've got that choice?
That is correct. And as things stand, the key difference between choosing to use it to buy an income-providing vehicle versus taking cash is two things. One, if you take it as a cash lump sum, you obviously get the lump sum now rather than drawing it as an income. But there is a tax consequence to taking that withdrawal, and that tax consequence can be quite a lot more material than if you were to draw it as an income. But yes, you can still take it as cash, or you could choose to annuitize it, as is the case today.
Sounds like the tax side of this thing can get quite complicated. So what's really changing when it comes to tax?
Okay, so I'm going to break it down into three elements of the journey, let's say, right? So there is contributions, so the build-up, and there is the way things are taxed while your money is invested, and then there is tax when you take cash out, right? Actually, only one element of those things is changing. So on the contributions, nothing is changing, same tax deductibility. While your assets are invested, nothing is changing. Your returns are still tax-free. And then in terms of accessing your money as cash, we just split that into two. The one is at retirement. So if you get all the way to retirement and you choose to take a portion as cash, nothing is changing. So what's actually changing is just if you do a withdrawal before retirement. In other words, from your savings component. As things stand, like we said earlier, you can access cash before retirement if you change employers, you resign or you're retrenched, etc. There you can choose to take cash. Today, that cash is subject to tax according to the retirement withdrawal tax tables. So you take the amount of money, you look at that specific tax table, which is specific to those types of withdrawals, and the amount of tax is calculated. That tax is quite punitive on the withdrawal, and it's intended to be, right? It's meant to be a disincentive to withdrawing so that you get to retirement with as much as possible. What's changing is on your savings component, if you do a withdrawal there, instead of applying that tax table, what's going to be applied is your marginal income tax rate. Maybe as an example, so what that means is say you have a savings component of 100,000 Rand and you say, I find myself in a financial emergency, I really need to withdraw all of this money. Okay, so you'll say, please withdraw my 100,000 Rand. In terms of tax, what SARS and your retirement fund are going to do is they are going to look at and determine what your marginal tax rate is, right? So there are standard income tax tables for all South Africans. For the first portion of your income, you know, you effectively pay no tax. Then it jumps up to about 18%. And then all the way up to very high income earners, the last bit of their income is being taxed at 45%, right? Now, for your income specifically, different parts of your income are in different parts of the tax bracket. So, you know, when you look at your salary, what you're actually seeing is your effective tax rate. What your savings component is going to be taxed at is the very top level of the tax bracket in which your income falls. So, you know, for a very high income earner, their effective tax rate might be 30-something percent, but their marginal tax rate might be 45. So for our client who's, you know, drawing 100,000, you know, say they're a top income earner, the marginal tax rate will be 45% will be deducted from the 100,000, which means instead of getting 100,000, your starting point is that you'll get 55,000. The other element that's worth keeping in mind is that SARS can also withhold any outstanding taxes that you might owe them. Now, that won't be the case for everyone, but in certain scenarios, that 55,000 might be reduced further to pay outstanding taxes. And what will end up in your bank account will be the net amount after all of these things have happened.
That sounds like it could be quite punitive. I mean, do you think that the fact that people will pay tax is going to dissuade people from withdrawing? Has that worked so far? I mean, you already said that we have higher taxes on withdrawals before retirement.
Yeah, like you said, taxes have been in place on withdrawals for a long time now, and it doesn't seem to have dissuaded people. If you ask me, do I think preservation is going to be improved because the rate at which you taxed has changed, or is it the fact that you can only access, you know, up to a third, so in other words, just your savings component? I would say the latter is what's going to improve preservation, because to date, people have been able to take 100% of their retirement funds. The withdrawal tax tables are very punitive. People have suffered taxes on those withdrawals, but it hasn't stopped them. Because if it was stopping them, we wouldn't be in the situation that we've been in to date, where preservation's been really low, people get to retirement with small balances. So I don't think the tax is going to dissuade a lot of people. And there is evidence in other markets that this has also been the case. There were a couple of markets that during COVID gave their retirement fund members access to their retirement funds. Australia was one, Peru, Chile were other examples. In Australia, they also subjected their withdrawals to tax. And what they saw in their market was of all the people that were eligible to do a withdrawal, half of them did a withdrawal in the first 10 days, despite the tax.
That's quite scary when you think of it just across the whole country and all the millions of people with money in, yeah, in retirement funds. I really hope we don't see that. I'd like to just quickly go back to something you said earlier. You said you can do one withdrawal per tax year. So if I'm getting towards the end of the tax year and I haven't done my withdrawal, I need to hurry up and make sure I get those forms in to get the money? I mean, what do I lose if I don't get it done? I then have to wait another year, or how important is it that I'm on the ball and get that withdrawal form in?
If there was a saying for your savings component, it's probably just because you can doesn't mean you should, right? So the aim is to not withdraw, but more directly to your question, what do you lose if you don't withdraw? And the answer is nothing, right? So if you don't do a withdrawal this tax year, the assets that are sitting in your savings component remain in your savings component for the next tax year and the next tax year and in five tax years' time. So when you ultimately get to an emergency and you need it, all of the assets that you might have accessed today will still be available for you to access then. The once per tax year is not about trying to create a frequency with which people should access. It's just saying that within any one tax year, you can only do it once if you really need to. So you lose nothing. Those assets remain in your savings component. You can access them all in a future tax year. So there's no rush from that perspective. In your example, if it was right at the end of February and you thought, actually, I really do have a financial emergency, like, do I have to rush to get it in by the end of Feb? You know, what happens if I miss it? Again, nothing, right? So if you only get everything in order in March or in April or in May, same assets are there, process your withdrawal, things are done. The only consequence that that has is that in that tax year, you've done your once-off withdrawal. So if something else dire was to rear its head within that same tax year, you'd have to wait till the next one. But there's no rush. You don't lose anything in terms of what's accessible.
That's interesting, Sean. What counts as a dire emergency? I mean, I, you know, need to take the car for a service, otherwise I can't get the kids to school, or, you know, I really want to go on that holiday and at the moment I'm going to be flying to, you know, not such a great destination. I can really improve that if I could get a bit more money. Are those things emergencies? What's an emergency?
So everyone will have a different definition of emergency. And I think you gave some good examples. So to some people, not being able to go to Mauritius might feel like an emergency. It's definitely not. I'm going to give what I think a fair definition is, but there's probably some nuances around the edge. Anything that is threatening your current, I say, livelihood, not lifestyle, not holiday. So your example of my car has broken down, it is not running, I cannot get to work, I cannot get to the shop, I cannot get my children to school. Those kind of things are real financial emergencies. An unexpected medical expense, if you don't have medical aid, that would threaten your life. Those kind of things are dire financial emergencies. And in those circumstances where, maybe another way to say it is, you actually have very little choice whether or not you respond, right? So your child has to get to school, you have to respond in some way. Your life is threatened, you have to respond in some way. If you don't have the ability to access a pool of assets in order to respond, your alternatives can be even worse than potentially accessing part of your assets. And by that, I mean forced to access debt, specifically high interest rate debt, which could put you in a far worse position, even relative to temporarily accessing a portion of your retirement fund. So it's those types of scenarios where you could potentially be looking to pull, you know, assets if you really needed to, because you have to respond. And if you didn't have access to that, the money you do have access to could be very expensive in terms of debt. It does link, though, to an important related topic, which is this concept of having an emergency fund. To date, because, for example, for retirement annuity fund members, they haven't been able to access any of their retirement fund. If you did want to build up a pool of assets, you had to do that separately in what is typically called an emergency fund. Just because you now have the savings component and it allows you to access it, you know, when needed, doesn't mean that people should stop building up an emergency fund. An emergency fund is an extremely useful mechanism in terms of having a pool of assets there for the types of emergencies that we've just described. Typically, rule of thumb is that you aim to have at least 3 months of your salary in that emergency fund. And again, if something was to come up, you're able to access that, cover the expense, and then carry on and build that back up. Having that in place, even in the two-pot system, is extremely useful because, A, it covers all the types of emergencies, you know, dire emergencies that we've just referenced, while at the same time allowing your retirement fund assets, including your savings component, to remain invested for as long as possible to get to retirement. And so only in extreme scenarios where you're having to pull your entire emergency fund and still need something else, would you then have to, you know, start looking at your retirement fund assets. So having both of those together is a very good way to go at things.
And can I always take everything that's there? So there's no cap on how much. I don't have to be worried that by not taking something, there might be some money that I then can't take the next time. Can I always, as it were, clean out the entire savings account?
Yes. There's only one restriction or rule, which is that you cannot withdraw less than 2,000 Rand. So if you go to a retirement fund and you say, I'd like to do a withdrawal for my savings component, I'd like 1,000 Rand. Doesn't matter how much is in your savings component. It could be a million, or it could be just that 1,000. That will be restricted, right? So you have to be withdrawing more than 2,000. But if you're withdrawing more than 2,000, there's no upper limit. You can withdraw whatever you like, and you can withdraw all the way up to 100% of your savings component. Again, not being encouraged, but yes, you know, at each point that you needed to do withdrawal, you could, strictly speaking, clean out the whole savings component and then have to start building that component up again.
Okay, well, in closing, Sean, this all sounded rather complicated. If we try and keep it simple, ultimately, how does one secure a sustainable income in retirement? What are the things that investors need to do?
One, you need to be contributing at a reasonable level. There are some rules of thumb in terms of what that means. So for someone starting out in their career, let's say you're 25, you've got 30, 40 years in front of you. Typically, people will suggest that you're saving in the region of 15 to 17% of your salary in your retirement fund. So contribute at a reasonable level. Contribute consistently from as early on as possible. Each year that you wait to save towards your retirement is a year lost, and you actually have to contribute quite a lot more to catch up for the previous years. Then comes two-pot, which will help us along in terms of the next thing, which is preserve your assets. Try not to withdraw along the way, because again, anything that you take out will either be lost in terms of assets available at retirement, or you'll have to top up later on, and again, you'll have to make up for lost time and lost investment returns. And then if you've gotten those three things right, reasonable level, continuously over a good amount of time, you also need to make sure that you are investing those assets in, you know, unit trust funds or other types of investments that are able to generate a good level of return. And by that, what I mean is you really need to be generating returns that are above inflation. You know, typically, in order to make all of these things work out, you're wanting returns in about the region of, you know, 4% to 6% above inflation. And if you're able to get all of those things right, you should reach retirement 60, 65 years of age with a good, call it nest egg, that will give you the opportunity to purchase an income providing vehicle that should be able to provide you with a good level of income, keeping pace with inflation for the rest of your life.
Thanks, Sean, for joining me. We chatted through a range of factors that retirement savers need to keep in mind once this two-pot system is implemented. There are a few key things that stood out for me. Withdrawing from or even depleting your savings pot will really eat into your retirement income. Investors should avoid treating their savings pot like a short-term investment. It really needs to generate real long-term returns, and it's an integral part of your retirement income. I really liked Sean's point that just because you can doesn't mean you should, and I think that really is a good way to think about the new savings pot. If you'd like to get in touch, please send an email to info@alangray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Alan Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit alangray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Richard Carter. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
There's a song that goes, "Money can't buy me love." And that's true. But then they told us, all you need is love, which anybody with a mortgage will tell you, most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care, but more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, It can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love, with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.